Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today, President Joe Biden and his team will begin to address what he described in his inaugural address as the, quote, cascading crises of our era. Yesterday, just hours after his inauguration, President Biden signed many actions and orders in an effort to dismantle the Trump administration's signature policies. Another president who walked into a job with huge and unique challenges at home and abroad was President Franklin Delano Roosevelt when he took the oath of office in 1933. FDR believed in the use of, quote, broad executive power to wage a war against the emergency. Julian Zelizar, historian at Princeton University, author and CNN political analyst, joins us now to talk about what President Biden is facing and what lessons we and he can learn from the past. Professor Zelizar, welcome back to All of It.
Thanks for having me again.
Listeners, we do want to hear from you. What do you think President Biden's priorities should be during his first 100 days in office? What would you like to see happen? Give us a call, 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280, or you can always tweet to us at @OlivetWNYC. So, Professor, as a historian watching the inauguration yesterday, what stood out to you as a historian?
Well, I mean, there was the enormity of the moment after the last month that we've been through and the turbulence and danger that unfolded on January 6th to actually just watch the transfer of power happen. It was hard not to remember everything that led up to that. It did feel like a change in era, although I'm not sure it is. It felt that way, meaning two fundamentally different types of presidents. This was almost the antithesis of President Trump. And finally, I just was pretty impressed by the way in which they crafted a day where it felt like an inauguration. In some ways, it was more exciting than traditional inaugurations, and yet there was barely a crowd there, and a lot of this was really geared toward television, but I thought they did a good job, and it was a model maybe for what inaugurations are going to look like in the future.
I'm curious what you thought about President Biden's address and his philosophy, and he stuck to this point, this idea, this message of unity.
Well, I mean, it's a test, meaning this has been a promise he's made throughout his career and throughout his campaign, that there is a possibility now still for bipartisan negotiation, for both sides to agree with each other. It runs against the direction of American history in the last few decades, where we've become more divided, where it's harder to do that. He'll face a Republican Party that has generally little interest in doing that. So it's a leadership question. I mean, maybe he has some secret that no one else knows about, and that would be one path forward. Or maybe it's a little bit like Obama, who also promised to move beyond red and blue America and in the end really couldn't do it.
Let's talk about this idea of walking into a presidency with unprecedented and enormous challenges. When FDR was inaugurated on March 4th, 1933, Hitler had rose to power in January of the same year, just months earlier, a week after the inauguration. Goebbels became the first propaganda minister at home. Every U.S. state had ordered all remaining banks to close at the end of the fourth wave of banking panics. The U.S. Treasury didn't have enough cash to pay all government workers. That's an incredible set of challenges. Of course, Biden's are different. His are unique. But when you think about some of the parallels between the what FDR walked into and what Biden's walking into, what are some of the lessons that could be learned?
Well, the biggest, I mean, just the biggest parallel for me is the way in which FDR's crisis and Biden's crisis domestically really just shook the entire fabric of the nation. This was not a short-term crisis. It was not something felt by pockets of the country. The Depression and the pandemic are things that have just ripped through all parts of American society, not just leaving us economically vulnerable, but hurting our social institutions, the pandemic hurting our ability to just see other people, and that affects schools, churches, synagogues, et cetera, et cetera. And so both face that. And one of the biggest, you know, lessons we always look back to in 33 is the ability of the president to use rhetoric to inspire and to guide Americans who are scared. And the inaugural address of FDR famously did that. I don't know yet if Biden's did, but I think that's part of his task. It's going to be policy, but it's also part of him being a source of a message that gives us confidence as we face this just horrendous situation. And then we can talk more about the other part of it is actually legislating.
Hmm. Actually, our Matt online too has a question, which brings us into that part of the conversation. Matt, thanks for calling all of it. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, Allison. Good afternoon, Professor Zelder. Thank you for taking my call. Pleasure to speak with both of you. My question is, I'm wondering in terms of, comparative scale, how you think these new programs laid out by the Biden administration will compare to a lot of the New Deal programs that FDR initiated in the early 30s. And also I'm wondering if you see any comparisons between the challenges that Woodrow Wilson faced in 1918 and 1919, as we saw the Spanish flu epidemic, although that was treated a bit differently, and also having to retool the economy post-war.
What a smart question. All,
very good questions. I mean, with FDR, I'm not sure we're going to have another New Deal here or another Great Society, even LBJ's programs. The initial push right now, it's pretty limited. I mean, Biden, other than the immigration bill, is not really setting out to remake what the government does and to push government to bold new directions. Much of what he's doing is putting his political capital in solving the pandemic. The major bill is really the economic stimulus and recovery bill, $1.9 billion. And a lot of the executive orders are connected to things like face masks on federal property and in interstate areas and working on the vaccine production and distribution. I think this is going to consume a lot more of his time. I don't think it's quite clear yet that this is going to be a period like 1933 to, say, 1936, where the social contract is fundamentally remade. I think Biden's ambitions are much more limited right now. Part of it's because of the pandemic and the many steps backwards that we are right now, like not having a vaccine plan, it turns out, to distribute it. And part of it is we're in an era where big legislation is incredibly difficult to do. And we just don't have bursts like the New Deal or Great Society happen anymore. And I think he's savvy enough to know that. So I see this as a much narrower scope, but just as important, given the severity of the crisis. And Wilson, of course, it just the timing was different. It was in the middle of his presidency, his second term. It was while also we were on wartime footing. And it was with a public health infrastructure that was much more underdeveloped than today. And ultimately, Wilson didn't put forth a kind of program that not consumes, but shapes domestic society so much. Even during the war, it was much more limited even than World War II. So I think this is going to be a scale much greater than what happened under Wilson now that President Biden's in office.
Let's go to Stephen, who is calling in on line one. Stephen, thanks for calling all of it. What do you think President Biden should be concentrating on?
Well, you're welcome, Allison. Thank you. Listen, what I want to see done, and with urgency, is I want to see the Patriot Act applied to the right-wing organizations and their funding that was responsible for what happened on January 6th, which was the culmination of Charlottesville. 3 years of unfettered, brazen action. Okay, the Patriot Act is meant for to take down terrorist organizations. The powers are broad, and they are they can take down these networks very quickly. Mm. All you have to do is invoke it.
Stephen, thank you for calling in. We Professor Zelizar, by the way, my guest yep. is Princeton Professor Julian Zelizar, a CNN analyst as well. Brian and I were on yesterday afternoon fielding calls, and we were trying to think, and neither of us could remember a president in an inaugural address ever saying the two words white supremacy.
Yes, I mean, that was really striking. And also said from the candidate who, or president, but a politician known from refraining from using language that could categorize him as being radical or something. But that was a radical thing to hear. But I think a needed part of his speech was to actually address this directly. And I think that call is really an important one. A lot of the speech and a lot of the discussion yesterday was about, can we bring sides together and can we curb extremism? But part of this will be a public policy challenge. Right-wing extremism is a real thing. And it's the same kind of threat that we faced from international terrorism. And I think there is an argument to be made, A, that we have to reverse cuts that have been made to programs with law enforcement and intelligence agencies to go after these groups. And B, he might have to even double down. I don't know if the Patriot Act is the vehicle he wants to do that. That's very controversial with Democrats. And he'll have to do this in a way that sits well with civil liberties. But I think that's one area there's room for Biden to go beyond the pandemic. And there's an urgency about it. January 6th was unacceptable. What happened. And it was dangerous. It was a threat not to a building, but to the people in the building and the process they were doing. And I think there's some room now for Biden to move on that. It would be hard for Republicans, many of them, to just say no to a push in that direction, because in that then they're just standing with the terrorists and they don't want to be, you know, perceived that way right now.
I did think it was interesting that a certain amount of pragmatism was in Biden's speech. He acknowledged, as he was talking about unity, that people think, and these are his words, some people thought it was foolish fantasy. What can a president do to win over detractors? Or do you, or has his detractors just gone too far down conspiracy rabbit holes? What can he do, and who can help him?
Yeah, I mean, look, I would say a lot of initial presidential speech making, including inaugural addresses, doesn't seem very realistic when it happens. Even FDR telling people we have nothing to fear but fear itself. Now we look back and it's like, boy, you know, what perfect rhetoric. But at the same time, if you're sitting there without a job, without money, and unable to feed anyone in your family, it probably, for some people, it sounded good, but it wasn't clear how do you actually do that. And so a lot of it's follow through. I mean, in terms of the pandemic, for example, it's going to matter how this administration rolls out and implements its own plan right now. And in terms of unity, it's going to be hard. I mean, he is not dealing, President Biden, with an opposition that is feeling very good about entering into an alliance with the Democrats. There's big differences on public policy. There's a totally different information ecosystem through which many Republican voters get their news. And there's also just an intense partisanship in the party leadership with Senator McConnell and the Republicans in the House that is, you know, almost hell-bent on opposition and obstruction. So I don't really know how he does that. I think I'll end by saying the best bet is to do well on the pandemic. I mean, the best thing that Biden has going for him is to be effective at ending this national nightmare that we're in. If he can do a lot between now and the summer, I think he'll have some more political capital to pressure more Republicans into at least having a conversation with him. I'm not sure right now there's a lot of space to do that.
My guest is Princeton Professor Julian Zelizar. We're talking about President Biden's priorities. Listeners, we do want to hear from you. What do you think President Biden's priorities should be during his first 100 days in office? What would you like to see happen? Our number 646-435-7280. We'll take your calls and have more with Professor Zelizar after a quick break. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest this hour is Professor Julian Zelizar of Princeton University, CNN analyst. We're talking about President Biden's first few months in office. What are some of the priorities? What can he learn from history? FDR passed 15 major pieces of legislation. 76 laws were passed during his first 100 days in office. Joe Biden got busy yesterday, passed numerous executive actions yesterday, imposing mask mandate on federal property, rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement, ending the so-called Muslim ban on travel. When did the first, this may sound an ignorant question, so forgive me, but when and why is this first 100 days seen as such a marker?
Well, it's artificial, and most historians do credit this burst that happens with FDR, not just with a lot of legislation, but a lot of important legislation, such as tackling the crisis of the banking system right off the bat, from a banking holiday to legislation to protect the deposits of Americans. I think since that time, he kind of really set a mark that we continue to use in our discussions. It's artificial. I mean, there's no reason we have to think of 100 days as the timeline for a presidency. A lot of what FDR did was after the 100 days. Social Security doesn't come until 1935, not 1933. But it's just, you know, it's like the inaugural address and the transition. We try to figure out ways to evaluate how a president is doing. And I think this is one of the ways we try to gauge this in the early months. It sometimes creates artificial pressure, I think, to tackle everything at once and to start saying a president's failing. I mean, there's presidents like Carter who have very successful first 100 days and are compared to FDR. And then the rest of their presidency doesn't go very well either.
That's so interesting, because I just wrapped up a long form interview with John Alter about his book, his very best, Jimmy Carter. And he did note, you know, that he had this robust first 100 days, and then it was a troubled presidency after that. Why didn't the former lead to the latter? Is that unique to Carter, or is this part of this false construct, you say, where you have this 100 days to do something, and then...
I think, like, when you are inaugurated, I was thinking of this as I watched yesterday, the minute that swearing in happens, you're president, and you and everyone on your staff knows the clock is ticking. And from the minute you finish that to the minute your term ends, things happen. I mean, it's not as if things don't happen after 100 days. And the way a president responds to that will make or break your presidency. I mean, part of FDR's success isn't that he had a great 100 days, it's that he continued to find ways to achieve success in 1935 or in World War II. And he, you know, had ups and downs during that presidency. And that's true of every executive. And also, opportunities to obtain legislation might not exist in the first 100 days. Sometimes it requires a crisis, for example, to open a window for policymaking. And that crisis might come in year three, and that will determine how people view your presidency. So that's part of why there's a fragility to using this marker to try to predict how the rest is going to unfold.
Let's take some more calls. Kate on line one is thinking outside the box on this. Hey, Kate, thanks for calling All of It.
Thank you. Okay, so I have an idea for the president. He needs to start a new cabinet position called Dove, D-O-V-E, Department of Voter Equality. And Stacey Abrams would run it. And I think we need to spend 8 years dealing with voter suppression, the fact that starting even at the local level, getting better people running, running the elections, getting better voting machines. And at the very top of the heap, you'd get rid of the Electoral College.
Thanks for calling in. Let's go to Judy on line two. Hi, Judy. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I suggest the first 100 days is very important to get a uniform educational system. Betsy DeVos wrecked the educational system by allowing charter schools to create their own curriculum. We need to have a uniform curriculum in the public schools and the junior highs. If you wait until high school, it's too late. Junior high school is the right time, and you need to have a mandatory curriculum for all junior high school children to learn what is a democracy, what's the difference between fascism and democracy, especially But also you can go into Marxism, communism, socialism, if you like. The main distinction is between fascism and democracy. And if that's not taught in junior high school, it's too late.
Thank you for the call, Judy. While Judy has us on the subject of education, I follow you on Twitter, so I know the answer to this. We had a very short-lived 1776. An education plan put forward in response to clearly the 1619 project. What were your thoughts when you read that?
My thoughts are what I predicted they would be. I mean, it was really a polemic. It was using history in the exact wrong way just to basically make a political point about Democrats. A lot of it was just really outrageous, even, you know, kind of fitting progressivism, which was about regulating child labor and improving, you know, standards for how Americans live, to fascism. It was just kind of amazing that got put forward as a government document. And there's debates about the 1619 project, and I have many colleagues who don't agree with parts of what's in there, and they've had public debates about this, and that's good. That's always a great thing. But this was not that. And I wasn't disappointed, because I didn't expect much more given how this was all set up from the start.
Geneva on Twitter says, bring back the fairness doctrine now, please. That's so interesting, because I think it was late 80s, 87, 88, that the 87, the FCC eliminated the policy. What are your thoughts on that, bringing back the fairness doctrine?
Yeah, I think there's a question about it, and that the fairness doctrine, that was a rule that the FCC kept in place from 1949 to 1987, and it told radio and television stations, if you're going to do something political, you had to put on both sides, or you were subject to end up in court. Didn't always work, but it was an important pressure on our media to try to achieve some kind of balance and objectivity. And in principle, I think it's a good thing. I think we need some form of policy that might push this. It's hard to do. I mean, it was all premised on the idea that the airwaves were limited back then, before cable and satellite technology. And once that was no longer the case, it became harder to justify and control. But I'm in favor of renewing some comparable form of policy that doesn't necessarily solve the kind of toxicity which has now been normalized in a lot of the media, but does start to kind of create pressures and maybe incentives for other forms of journalism.
Former President Trump is out of office. He still faces an impeachment trial in the Senate. What happens next?
Well, we don't know if the Senate is going to do the trial as the sole event, or something like a two-track system, which I know the Biden administration is pushing for. My guess is it will last a couple of weeks. I don't think Senator Schumer will allow this to run on forever. I think it will, you know, bring some very important questions to the table. And the question that we don't know is, are enough Republicans either moved by the trauma of what they experienced, or moved by political fears that if they don't vote to indict him, it's going to cost them over the long term in terms of winning back a majority. And I don't know which way it will go. I do think Biden can afford to have this happen, and it doesn't inevitably mean he's going to be sidetracked. I think he can use executive action. He can focus on negotiations with the House, which is where legislation starts, and allow the Senate to do this. And in the end, it might be a good moment for him, meaning a good moment to have Congress deal with accountability and deal with the horrific events that unfolded on January 6th before the clock really starts running for his legislative agenda.
Princeton professor, historian, and author Julian Zelizer, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.